This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm Caleb Brown. One of the easiest ways for communities to enable new housing and other dynamic development is actually quite simple. Get rid of minimum parking requirements. Instead, argues Nolan Gray, author of Arbitrary Lines, cities should let property owners figure it out for themselves.
Whenever I see glorious architectural firm designs with, you know, the little fake people walking around and enjoying themselves and at these various like venues that are going to be built, like expensive shopping centers or arenas or stadiums, inevitably, when you see the aerial shot or the aerial design, huge parking lots, I mean, massive parking lots. And just driving around my small town, the stores are so far from the street because of huge parking lots. And I wonder, because these parking lots are rarely ever anywhere near half full, who makes that decision? How does that decision get made?
Right. You look around the American built landscape and there's just loads and loads of parking. And there's two possibilities here. The first possibility is all this parking really is just demanded by the market, right? Like if you want to start a business or you want to build housing, maybe you do just have to have loads of parking. But as you note, and many people have observed this, a lot of that parking goes unused, right? And so it would be kind of strange if the market was just building loads and loads of parking that even on Black Friday is not even fully used, right? So another possibility, and one that I'll argue is what's the main factor here, is that in many cases, local governments often require off-street parking to be built as a condition for receiving permits. So these are rules called minimum parking requirements, which essentially say for every 1,000 square feet of commercial space, you need to have 5, 10, 20 parking spaces. For every apartment you build, you need to have 1, 2, 3 parking spaces, sometimes modified by bedroom. And what this produces is an American-built landscape that has loads and loads of parking, often well above what the market might otherwise provide. And all of that parking gets priced into the cost of higher goods and services and higher housing costs.
If I compare like the main drag in my town, the main drag being where all the commercial growth has occurred over the last several decades, to the actual downtown area, it's night and day in terms of what the parking requirements are. And it doesn't seem to me that the businesses in the downtown area are clamoring for additional parking. Like, please tear down this vacant building next to me. I'll buy it so that I can have 10 more parking spaces. It doesn't seem like there's anything like that going on. So, you know, for business people or for local government officials who think that minimum parking requirements are really important, what should they understand about the dynamics of cities and about commerce?
That's a really great question. You know, I mean, look, if you're starting a business or you're trying to build and sell apartments or housing, the incentives are aligned, right? If you build too much parking, you'll have wasted a lot of money. If you build too little parking, you won't be able to lease out the space, right? So the people actually building new developments have the incentives right to get the correct amount of parking. Now, what minimum parking requirements come in and do is they second guess that. And they say, well, no, actually, planners are going to come in and tell you the appropriate amount of parking based on ratios that in many cases were calculated decades ago and on very, very, very small sample sizes. I mean, you can look at the actual parking manuals that a lot of the cities rely on, and these were done literally decades ago and with sample sizes of like 4 or 5 observations, right? And from this, they're telling market actors who have major financial incentives how much parking they should be building. I would suggest to, you know, a lot of local elected officials, this is actually something that the market is really good at handling. We don't need government regulators telling people how much parking is and is not necessary.
I love sidewalks. I think they should be in more places where they currently are not. Hint to my local political overseers in my town. And so the off-street parking typically serves as, you know, sometimes a pretty large separation, sometimes 100 yards between the sidewalk and the actual storefront. And that is, I don't know, it's kind of ugly.
Right, right. Well, Shelbyville's lucky to have you, Caleb, doing in the work, right? No, I mean, you raise an important point, right? Which is that in addition to just raising the cost of goods and services or raising the cost of housing, these minimum parking requirements effectively make it illegal to build a traditional pattern of urban development like what you see on many historic main streets in Kentucky and across the country, right? It's illegal to build a pattern of development maybe where the shops sit close to the street And maybe there are apartments or offices over top. In many cases, because so much parking is required that it just simply doesn't work on these smaller lots. It doesn't work at a more granular human scale level of development. And again, there might be context where you do have, you know, the classic big box store set behind a large parking lot. But there might also be preferences for these small, intimate communities where you can build close to the street and have a smaller pattern of development. You know, I would say even in places where you might not get that type of development, you nearly always have a historic downtown, a historic Main Street, where in many cases, it's actually illegal to use those properties for shops or illegal to convert the second or third floors into apartments or offices because the parking requirement is so high. So even just purely from a downtown revitalization perspective, these minimum parking requirement rules often make that infeasible. And that's often why so many of these downtown storefronts sit completely vacant, is there's this whole list of rules and regulations that say, well, that property is technically illegal under our current zoning. And so until you bring it up to code, you're not allowed to use it. And that means, I would say, deforming the actual urban fabric.
That's fascinating that, you know, when people complain about downtowns going away or just, you know, atrophying and storefronts remaining empty, the notion that a minimum parking requirement could prevent turning it into sort of a vibrant, mixed-use, commercial, residential area that could be, frankly, really cool. And we simply have no way of knowing if that experiment would take off just given the regulatory environment.
Right. And this is the thing, right? You know, give people choice, give people options about what their city might look like and see what happens, right? I mean, I think we understand this in so many other markets, right? Reveal preference. Let people decide how much parking is necessary. Let people decide maybe what their buildings look like, so, you know, so long as they're compliant with some basic health and safety considerations, and we'll see what people actually prefer. And the way we plan our cities takes the complete opposite approach. We're going to have a set of rules and regulations for exactly what all new development has to look like. And if you want to go outside those very narrow bounds, you have to come and ask for permission, right? And that makes it very hard to adaptively reuse our historic downtown. It makes it very hard to build new, maybe walkable, mixed-use downtowns, and it locks our development into a pattern of sprawling growth behind giant parking lots that I think, as you and many others feel, is kind of unappealing.
I live in a small town, but in larger cities, I assume where land is expensive, that where a minimum parking requirement simply could not be met by buying square footage on earth, that you have to go down and up in order to comply. So do big cities get this in a way that smaller towns might not? Or do we see buildings getting built that have layer upon layer of arguably unnecessary parking into the ground and maybe a couple of floors up above the ground?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, we've been talking about small towns. We've been talking about suburbs, but where these minimum parking requirement rules are really, really binding is in cities, right? Because in cities, you might have a lot of uses within walking distance. You might have bus stops. A lot of people might actually prefer to live car-free or car-light, right? You might have many commercial uses or offices that can accommodate people without cars, right? And what parking requirements do is they come in and say, well, notwithstanding the fact that everybody who comes here or lives here maybe would prefer not to have a car, doesn't need a car, we're going to require you to build all of this off-street parking. In a place like DC, where you have strict height limits, that means you have to excavate down, right? You have to build these giant parking garages deep into the earth, right? In a place like Austin, you see these towers of parking garages, right? These, you know, in many cases, 5-10 stories of required parking. And as my, you know, mentor here at UCLA likes to say, that the godfather of parking policy, Donald Shoup, there's no such thing as free parking, right? We mandate all this parking. It has to be priced for free. But all that parking is priced into the cost of a new home, right? If you have to build underground structured parking or a new parking garage, that can increase the price of a new two-bedroom condo by $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, in some jurisdictions, $80,000, right? And again, some households might want to make that trade-off. They might say, yeah, I'm willing to pay a lot more to have an off-street parking space. But others might say, well, I'd prefer a slightly cheaper unit and maybe one fewer parking space or no parking space at all. And these regulations do not give consumers that choice.
To the extent that cities or localities really are cognizant of this problem and cognizant of the economics of it and the difficulties that it imposes on businesses and individuals alike, are there places that just get this and have made a different decision? And what can we say with confidence about the results that they've had?
Absolutely. You know, I think this is the rare policy area where we're actually seeing a lot of exciting progress. So in 2017, Buffalo, New York, and Hartford, Connecticut were the first two major American cities to completely abolish minimum parking requirements, right? Saying that, look, we're going to let the market decide how much parking needs to be built for new development. And that was really motivated by a desire to actually facilitate the adaptive reuse of a lot of these historic properties that, as we've discussed, didn't have tons of off-street parking. But we've seen this issue completely take off like wildfire. There's a group, the Parking Reform Network, they've put out a map of the progress of parking reform. And what you see is that all across the country, cities are removing these requirements. Just recently here in California, Sacramento eliminated parking requirements citywide. At the state level here in California, bills like AB 2097 have removed parking requirements within a half mile of transit, right? Removing them in the places where they made the least sense and were probably most binding on what the market would have otherwise done. So that's very exciting. You know, I got to get the Kentucky reference in here. Lexington, Kentucky, where I'm from, completely eliminated parking requirements. So this is happening in cities big and small. It's happening in places with great transit. It's happening in places without great transit. It's saying, look, the principle applies everywhere. The market incentives are correctly aligned here. Give people choice and let people decide the right amount of parking for themselves and don't have this be decided by regulatory fiat.
Yeah, I wonder what my downtown might look like if they were able to convert a lot of the currently empty storefronts into housing and allow people to live a car-free lifestyle with, you know, within walking distance of most of the commerce that they would need on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I think that occasionally, right, folks will say, oh, well, we don't need to worry about minimum parking requirements here because everybody has a car. We don't have great transit alternatives. And it's like, well, you know, we don't really know what the alternative is until we allow it, right? And, you know, it might be the case that, yeah, there might not be a preference for that mode of living. But as long as the regulations do not allow people to live that way, we simply can't say one way or another. You know, a lot of people look at the American built landscape and they say, well, this is the result of revealed preference. And I would suggest, no, actually quite the contrary. If you understand regulatory frameworks like zoning or minimum parking requirements, you understand that the American built landscape as it exists today is the result of some of the most extreme central planning probably in human history. And so we don't really know what people would prefer. And exactly to your point, Caleb, it might be the case that many people would say, hey, we're downsizing empty nesters. Why don't we move into the downtown and live within walking distance of our church or a park or a supermarket? Or, hey, I'm a young professional. Why not live in a studio where I'm within a bicycle ride of my job? If prices are any indication, many Americans desperately want that choice and we don't give that to them. And so, you know, I think this movement to eliminate minimum parking requirements, I think, is an exciting first step in that direction.
Nolan Gray is author of the book Arbitrary Lines, How Zoning Broke the American City and How to Fix It. We spoke last month. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you please. And thank you for listening.